So this afternoon, I see we have the faithful remnant here, and this is where it gets really interesting. You know, I wasn't going to spill the beans for the people who only turn up when there's the Lord Mayor's show in town, but for those who are sincere seekers after truth, here we are. So we're going to look at understanding the plots of Bible stories. And the first thing we need to address is, what in the world is a plot? Well, let me spend a little bit of time to begin with talking about the significance of plot before I describe what it actually is. Okay, I think that's the best way around. Now, the first thing I should say, I think, is that when we talk about the plots of Bible stories, biblical stories, it isn't that biblical stories are the only stories that have a plot or plots. Every story has a plot. If a story doesn't have a plot, it isn't a story. So we're looking at the basic structure of what a story is and applying that to the stories that we find in the Bible. And I think when we do that, we get an insight into how this story in the Bible actually works, how it moves ahead, how it makes its point. Now, we can read a biblical story without being aware of plot. And I admit that I did that for decades, you know? I read a biblical story blissfully unaware of what a plot is. And I still think I maintain my relationship with the Lord, despite the fact I was ignorant of plots. But when I discovered what a plot is, as John Wesley said, I felt my heart strangely warmed, because it gave me an insight into how stories are organized and how they present themselves. An advantage of understanding what the plot of a story is this: it helps us to see the relative importance of various parts of the story. Now, of course, we can say that every element in a biblical story has some importance, otherwise it wouldn't be there. However, where are we likely to find the most important point in the story? And that's where understanding plots help us to sift between the less important and the more important. Because there's always the danger, I mean, I have sinned in this regard, where I go to a biblical story and I find a verse, or maybe half a verse, that confirms one of my prejudices. That's the point of the story. I'm vindicated in that half or quarter of a verse where we get these few words. But if we can learn to read the stories so that we place the emphasis where the emphasis should be, rather than, you know, the typical bad sermon, I know what I want to tell them, I've just got to find a good verse to prove it. All right. You may have heard, I assume, the apocryphal story of the Adventist pastor before he preaches, who gives his scripture reading, and he turns to the passage in Matthew's Gospel, where you remember Salome dances before King Herod, and King Herod is very pleased with Salome's dancing. And he says to her, "You may ask whatever you wish. I will give it to you." She asks her mother, and her mother says, "Ask for the head of John the Baptist on a plate." And that's what she does. And so John the Baptist, the greatest of the prophets before Christ, is executed. Remember, that's the passage. And the pastor reads that passage, then looks at the congregation and says, "And the topic of my sermon this Sabbath is the dangers of dancing. Now, of course, there might very well be dangers in dancing, and that might well be the basis of a sermon, but I suggest not on the basis of that passage, because the main point, even if you don't understand plot, the main point of this passage is not, don't go to the dance hall. All right. And so understanding plot helps us avoid that pitfall. So just to repeat what I've said at the outset, all stories have a plot, whether we're talking about a novel, the latest episode in a TV soap opera, or a Bible story. They all have a plot structure, but what exactly is a plot, and how does it help us to understand Bible stories? So let's get started on that. There's more than one way in which to outline the plot of a story, but I'm going to use, for our purposes today, a classic and I think the simplest way of doing this, because I think this is most helpful. So in a classic plot, there are five steps. So a classic plot structure has got five steps to it as we work our way through a story. So I'm going to begin with a very short story, this time from Matthew's Gospel. It's only two verses long. I mean, any shorter, you know, and you wouldn't really be able to squeeze a story in this. Very short story. When Jesus entered Peter's house, he saw his mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. He touched her hand, and the fever left her, and she got up and began to serve him. It's a very short story. But, like all stories, this story has a plot. Okay, so we're going to look at what that is. The first step in a plot is the initial situation. What does the initial situation give us? Well, it gives us information concerning characters and their situation. And the initial situation requires development for the plot to progress. So we're given some information at the beginning of the story, but something has to happen in order to move it along, all right? So the initial situation here is when Jesus entered Peter's house. When Jesus entered Peter's house, that's the initial situation. Can you see him going into Peter's house? Something's got to happen to make this a story. So the next, second stage is the complication. The complication moves the story away from that initial status quo, from that initial situation. It's, if you like, the trigger point that moves the narrative forward. And quite often what will move it forward is a problem of some kind. It doesn't necessarily have to be a life-changing problem, but it means something is this trigger point that moves the story on. Something has to happen. He saw Peter's mother-in-law lying in bed with a fever. That's a complication, because this requires some response. The third step, then, in the classic plot is, it's given different names, and I've been trying to come up with something which is truly descriptive, and I haven't come up with anything yet. So this is the term that is generally used, all right? Transforming action, which means what we get next is the means of managing the complication or the means of responding to the complication. So what was the complication in this story, do you remember? Yeah, that mother-in-law has a fever. The transforming action, the response to it, he touched her hand. That's what he responds to it. He touches her hand. Fourth step in the plot, the resolution. And the resolution concludes the move that's been started by the transforming action. Okay, he touched her hand. And it resolves the issues introduced by the complication. Now, what was the complication in this story? Yeah, his mother-in-law, Peter's mother-in-law, has a fever. The resolution has to resolve that complication, at least partially. So, what happens? And the fever left her, and she got up. Then the final and fifth point in a five-fold plot structure of a story is the final situation. And this brings the story to a resting place, and it returns to the initial situation, or it moves on to a new settled state. So what happens here? And she began to serve him. Now, if you ever forget, because I'm assuming that you might want to build on what we're doing today, if you ever forget what a plot is, just write down Matthew 8, 14 to 15. And you can read that short story and it will refresh your memory as to what a plot is. So let me give you a summary of what we've done. This is the plot of this story. The initial situation, Jesus entered Peter's house. The complication, his mother-in-law had a fever. The transforming action, he touched her hand. The resolution, the fever left her, she got up. And the final situation, she began to serve him. Now, can you see that there is a very close relationship between the complication and the resolution? The complication is that his mother-in-law had a fever, and the resolution is that the fever left her. That's the core of the story. Where does this story come to its climax? In this story, I think, as in most stories, you find the heart of the story, what the story is about, in the resolution. The fever left her, and she got up. That's what this story is about, of Christ healing this woman. And although this is a short story, what does she do? Once the fever's left her, she began to serve him. Now that's interesting, especially when you read it in the context of the first century, because in the first century, women were not allowed to serve rabbis. It's not just in the 21st century we argue about what women can do before the Lord. All right? They had it in the first century. But because she's been healed, she serves him. So the fact that he can heal her shows there's something unusual about this rabbi. And the fact that she serves him shows something else unusual about this rabbi. It's a different kind of teaching. So that's, as I said, a very short story. Let's look at one that's longer, so there's more time for the story to develop. And we're going to look at a well-known biblical story, 2 Samuel chapter 11. We alluded to it in the sermon this morning. So on the left there, I'm going to include the definitions. But the initial situation, okay, how do things start? In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all Israel with him. They ravaged the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. There's the initial situation. And when we read that, I'd suggest, if you're attuned to biblical stories and to plots, we know in our bones something is going to happen. Why do I say that? At the time of year when kings go out to battle. So at the time of year when kings go out, King David stays in. The time of year when kings go out, this king stays in. Something is going to happen. Complication. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. And missing out one or two crucial details, the woman conceived and she sent and told David, "I'm pregnant." Is that a complication? You bet that's a complication. This is a complication with bells on. There's the complication. The transforming action, all right? The means of managing or responding to the complication. So what's David going, how's he going to respond to that complication? So, I've had to condense this to fit it on. So David sent word to Joab, send me Uriah the Hittite. And David said to Uriah, go down to your house and wash your feet. But Uriah did not go down to his house. In fact, he refuses to go down several times. And in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting so that he may be struck down and die. That's how I'm going to manage this problem. That's the transforming action. The resolution. How does all this resolved? How is the complication going to be resolved? As Joab was besieging the city, some of the servants of David among the people fell. Uriah the Hittite was killed as well. The messenger said to David, your servant Uriah the Hittite is dead also. And David said to the messenger, do not let this matter trouble you. For the sword devours now one, and now another. Do not let this matter trouble you, because I can tell you it's not troubling me one little bit. There's the resolution to the problem. Get rid of the husband. Simples. Final situation. When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But you notice the final sentence. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord. It's the first mention of God in the entire story. Right at the end. This is the final situation of this episode. But that final sentence suggests this isn't the end of this story. But this story, like the previous story, five steps. Let me actually just quickly go back. Remember I said that the heart of the story you're likely to find in the resolution? Let's just click back to that. This resolution tells us how Uriah is killed, but it leads up to this statement by David. This is the heart of the matter. Do not let this matter trouble you, for the sword devours now one and now another. You know, these things happen. Well, I would say the main point of the story of David and Bathsheba is that these things don't just happen. They happen because David has engineered this. He is lying through his teeth. That is the heart of the matter in the resolution. The rest of the story has brought us up to that point. So, just to summarize the five steps, fivefold structure. Initial situation, complication, transforming action, resolution, final situation. That is the full-blown fivefold plot structure. However, you don't always get all five steps in a plot. But virtually every narrative, every biblical story will have three, at least three. And the three which seem to be absolutely essential, pretty much, are the initial situation. Well, if you've got no initial situation, you can't really get started, can you? All right? Initial situation, complication, and resolution. Those are the three critical ones. And sometime, many times, you'll have a transforming action, and many times you'll have a final situation, but not necessarily. Sometimes the resolution, for example, will do double duty. The resolution is both the resolution and the final situation. Now, I'm sure you've absorbed all that, because that was fairly straightforward, wasn't it? Wasn't it? Right. I need confirming, you know. Yeah, thank you. So, Paul, you have a few sheets of paper. I'm going to give you a short New Testament story, and I'd like you to, actually, if you do that, Seth, I can do, if you give me half of them, I'll take the others over there. Okay, thanks. You might need to share, but you're all good friends, right?
Yes.
We've got a few spares there. Okay. So actually, I forgot what have I given you? Mark 12, 13 to 17. The reason there are margins, you know, if you've got a pen or a pencil, you can mark it up and see. There's your fivefold plot structure. Now, read this story and try to provide the plot structure of this story, all right? You can discuss it. You know, if you're afraid of doing it by yourself, you can discuss it with the person sitting next to you. I'm going to give you a few minutes to do that, and then we'll see how you've done. Getting there? You need a bit more time on this? You're more or less finished? Yeah, okay, so let's see. Let's see how you go. So we need some brave souls to speak with conviction on this. Now, we've got these five steps we're going through. Now, occasionally, and you may have found this as you were looking at this story, you might think, where exactly does one step end and where does the next one begin? Where exactly do I draw the line? All right, well, there will be some differences of opinion. So, you know, it's the general movement that we're looking at, so there might be minor differences of detail as to exactly where we draw the line, all right? But the initial situation, now Mike is here with a microphone, so this gives you confidence to, you know, that your words will be recorded. Who would like to suggest what the initial situation is? I'll say this, is the easiest of the lot. Which is the initial situation? Where might it begin, do you think?
I think it's verse 13.
Okay, so let's do this. So then they sent to him some Pharisees and some Herodians to trap him in what he said. Okay, so that's where you'd have the initial situation as that's ending here. Is that... Would all of you agree on that, or you got others have got suggestions? Some of you'd like to have the next verse. And they came and said to him, "Teacher, we know that you are sincere and show deference to no one." By the way, when people come to you and you say that, you know trouble is brewing. You know, Pastor, I know. I'd just like to thank you for that wonderful sermon. It warmed my heart. And the longer it goes on, you know that somewhere a but is going to appear. Somewhere, you know. Yes, now, so Who would like to include verse 14 in the initial situation? All of it or not? Or are most of you wanting to stay with verse 13?
You have to transition at least as where it says, is it lawful?
Yeah, that's getting to the, yes, okay.
So that's the latter part of 14.
Yes.
Right.
So I think you're right. So you can't really leave the complication to start any later than that, at the latest. But remember, the movement from one section to the next can be a little bit fluid. But we've got an obvious initial situation, don't we? Okay. The complication, then. Where is the complication? You might want to begin at verse 14, but you might want to begin late as this. But where does it end?
Is it lawful to pay taxes? A blunt question. Should we pay them or should we not?
Yeah.
That's the complication.
Right. So the end of the complication would come here, right? At the... Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? Should we pay them or should we not? That basically is the complication. This is the question that demands some response from Jesus. All right. What about transforming action? The means of responding to the complication. Okay, we'll just get somebody to...
There's another one. Bring me a denarius and let me see it. And they brought one.
Yes. Bring me a denarius and let me see it. Do you notice, however, that if we start here, but knowing their hypocrisy... Those of you who were here last night... remember, we're looking at if a story tells us what somebody is thinking or knowing, it gives us an insight. And what does Jesus know? He knows that they are hypocrites. Now, we might have thought that, but Jesus knows it. So I'd suggest we can't say, I don't think they're hypocrites. I think they're actually, you know, members in good and regular standing. No. Okay? Jesus knowing the hypocrisy. So you could begin your transforming action there, possibly. Knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why are you putting me to the test? Bring me a denarius and let me see it. And they brought one. Okay? I'd suggest more or less that is the transforming action. What's the resolution then? Now remember, the resolution is significant. This really gets us to the heart of this narrative. What is the resolution?
Verse 17.
Jesus...
Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's.
Okay. Give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God's. Would you agree that that's the resolution? Yeah.
I would involve also, then he said to them, whose head is this and whose the title? And they answered, emperor's. Then Jesus said to them, give to the emperor's the things that are the emperor's and to God the things that are God.
Yeah. So we could say the resolution could well begin here. He said to them, and it's a dialogue, right? And so beginning here and ending there.
Yeah.
All right, more or less in agreement with that?
I would say it has to be earlier. If you don't take any notice of what comes when he says, bring me a denarius, but knowing their hypocrisy, he said to them, why are you putting me to the test? Bring me a denarius. If you don't put that in, then the answer has no meaning, does it? Whose head is this? Has to go earlier.
So you start the resolution earlier?
Yeah. Knowing their hypocrisy.
All right.
That's all a part of his answer to that
Right. So if we start the resolution here, then we don't really have a transforming action.
Yeah, but...
Because this is the end of the complication.
Yeah. But I think in this particular story, all the five sections blend into each other.
Yes. Yeah, so it isn't... That's a good point. It isn't that we've got a brick wall between each one. There's a flow from one to the next. So we don't have to get down... to arm wrestling over it's here or there, but we can see the general movement of this story, initial situation, complication, transforming action, resolution. It's good that we can agree to differ on exactly where to do it. First of all, we're Christians and we want to be in, but also you can't analyze stories in the same way you can a chemical formula, you know. Now, here's the difficult bit then. If that's the end of the resolution, what's the final situation? This requires a great deal of insight here. The final situation is they were utterly amazed at him, at the answer that he gave. So, this is how I analyzed it. Pretty much along the same lines as you. And as I say, you know, sometimes you can argue over exactly where one section ends and one begins, but it's the stepping our way through the plot which is the important thing. The initial situation, then they sent to him some Pharisees and some Herodians to trap him in what he said. I thought verse 13, do we include part of verse 14? Maybe we do, maybe we don't. But, you know, let's not lose our Christian experience over that. Complication. They said to him, teacher, we know that you're sincere. Is it lawful to pay taxes to the emperor or not? Should we pay them or should we not? On second thoughts, I think I'd now put, knowing their hypocrisy, I think I'd now put that in the transforming action, actually. And then he asked them the question concerning that, and they answered the emperor's. And the resolution, Jesus said to them, give to the emperor the things that are the emperor's, and to God the things that are God's. Now, intuitively, I think we probably recognize that is the heart of this story, even if you don't know anything about a plot, right? You sense that is the important, really important point. However, when you recognize that what you see as the most important part of the plot actually is the resolution, you can see that you've been analyzing plots all your life without realizing it. But now that you are aware of a plot structure, you can apply that to any Bible story in order to help you discover what's the main issue here. What's the main point? Find the resolution and you're 95% of your way there. Just one moment. What I've given you then is a standard classic fivefold plot. And the ones we've looked at so far do this decently and in order. They start at the beginning and they go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But that is just the basic grid, because you find stories which play with a plot structure. You know, once you know what it is, you see the storyteller saying, I know you know what a plot is. I'm going to tease you a little bit in here. You see what happens. So let me look at one final story. And this is the story of Abraham in Genesis 18. Now, just before this, just to set it in context, so you remember... Abraham has received guests at his tent, and he has provided them with a meal, and he's now setting them on their way. All right, so this is the beginning of this next episode. Initial situation is this. Then the men set out from there, and they looked towards Sodom, and Abram went out with them to set them on their way. Okay, had folk home for Sabbath lunch, and you're saying, see you next week. All right, that's the initial situation. the complication, a longer one. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? By the way, who is the Lord speaking to?
Himself.
In other words, this is an insight into what God's thinking. What does God know? Therefore, it is always important. Yeah. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do, seeing that Abraham shall become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? No, for I have chosen him that he may charge his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing righteousness and justice, so that the Lord may bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. Then the Lord said, okay, this is the impression that he's actually speaking to Abraham now. Then the Lord said, how great is the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah, and how very grave their sin. I must go down and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry that has come to me, and if not, I will know. This is the complication. This is the trigger point in the story, all right? Moves us on from just simply saying, nice to have you for a meal, to something far more serious. This is the trigger point in the story. Transforming action. So the men turned from there and went towards Sodom, while Abraham remained standing before the Lord. And then Abraham came near. How is Abraham going to deal with this revelation from God? All right? Abraham came near and said, will you indeed sweep away the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Will you then sweep away the place and not forgive it for the 50 righteous who are in it? Far be it from you to do such a thing, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous fare as the wicked. Far be that from you. Shall not the judge of all the earth do what is just? Well, this is fairly up close and personal with God, isn't it? This is how Abraham is responding to that complication. And then we get the resolution. And the Lord said, if I find at Sodom 50 righteous in the city, I will forgive the whole place for their sake. And then we expect, what comes next? After the resolution, we get final situation. That's what we're looking forward to. Not here. Because we get again a second transforming action. Abraham answered, let me take it upon myself to speak to the Lord. I am who but dust and ashes. Suppose 5 of the 50 righteous are lacking. Will you destroy the whole city for lack of 5? Second resolution. And he said, I will not destroy it if I find 45 there. And again, a third transforming act. Again he spoke to him, suppose 40 are found there. He answered, for the sake of 40, I will not do it. And again, a fourth transforming action. Again he spoke to him, suppose 30 are found there. Fourth resolution. He answered, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And again, a fifth transforming action. He said, let me take it upon myself to speak to the Lord. Suppose 20 are found there. Fifth resolution. He answered, for the sake of 20, I will not destroy it. And again, sixth transforming action. And he said, oh, do not let the Lord be angry if I speak just once more. Suppose 10 are found there. And he answered, for the sake of 10, I will not destroy it. Well, by now we're saying, have we got there yet? Is he going to get the Lord down to 0? Final situation. And the Lord went his way when he had finished speaking to Abram. And Abram returned to his place. So you see here we get a variation on that fivefold step. You know, we go initial situation, complication, transforming action, resolution, and again and again. You see the wheel spinning in the middle, and again and again. What does that do to you? If you know what a plot is, you say, have we got, it's like children in the car going on holiday. Are we there yet? We've got about another 5 or 6 to go, I'm sorry, you know. So it underlines what's going on, and then the final situation. And then we sit back, look at the story, and we smile, and we say, you know, I've gained insight into this. With Abraham engaging God in some kind of bizarre auction for the souls of Sodom, and God coming down and down.
Just having thought about this. Might I suggest as an alternative possibility, yeah, the initial situation actually continues from verse 16 right through to the end of verse 22. The men set out, Abraham goes with them, the Lord talks to himself, the Lord talks to Abraham, the men turn away, go towards Sodom, Abraham remains standing before the Lord. That is the initial situation. The complication only arises, Abraham comes and says, will you really sweep away the righteous with the wicked?
Ah, right.
Just a thought.
Yeah. At college, when people used to make, you know, difficult observations, I say, yeah, write me a paper on that. You know, we'll. there we go. Well, yeah, let me look at that. I mean, that may be possible. Without thinking on my feet explicitly, that could be the case. The main point here I was trying to make was that plots don't necessarily all go in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 sequence. That's the basic grid, but there are variations on it. I'll have a look at your suggestion. That could be the case. Yeah.
One other question. Is there a structure for analyzing more of a meta-narrative? Because this was an episode or a scene in a larger plot.
Yeah.
So is each little scene kind of followed the plot summary of a story, but is there some way of analyzing the larger story? Because this isn't the end of it. This just sets up the for what comes
That's
next.
That's right. Well, essentially, you get plots of individual episodes, but you can have a plot structure for an entire, you know, meta-narrative, you know, the larger narrative. So, as Adventists, right, we're used to the great controversy. You got the great controversy in your mind? Does the great controversy have a plot? Well, let's see. What was the initial situation? Okay, so, yeah, everything fine in heaven and wherever. Was there a complication? Okay, yeah. Transforming action. Yeah, it moves to earth. Isn't it? Resolution. Yeah, through Christ. Now, with the resolution, we've got an element of the resolution as John puts it in his gospel, you know, the already and the not yet. But the final situation will be? Yeah, a restoration, okay, after the millennium and so on. Well, that was only done very roughly, but you see, you can't get a narrative with much greater cosmic sweep than the great controversy, but it has a plot structure, right? Yes. Yeah. So when you see a plot structure, it isn't a matter of reducing a profound story to some kind of bumper sticker. You know, you've condensed it to that, but it gives you a perspective on how the story is put together, where it's going, and where the emphases are. Now, in the great controversy, what would, out of the five steps that we went through, what would you say is the most important? Christ, his death, his resurrection, we would say that intuitive. Well, that happens to be the resolution. So he underlines the fact, as I would say it, that it's the resolution of a story which points out the relative importance. Everything in that story is important, has some importance, but some parts are more important than others, ultimately. I'll just make this, it's just a very brief point, and then we've got time for questions, okay? And it comes back to this point about the larger narrative being made up of individual episodes. When we read one episode, we move through and we come to the final situation, and then there's an episode which follows, and one that follows that. What often happens is that the final situation of this episode becomes the initial situation of the next episode, and then that goes on, and then one comes on there. For example, again concerning Abraham, the final situation of one episode is this. This is where he's gone down into Egypt and he's passed his wife off as his sister. You remember that story? The final situation is, and Pharaoh gave his men orders concerning him, and they set him on the way with his wife and all that he had. That's how that episode comes to a conclusion. How does the next episode begin? So Abram went up from Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, into the Negev. So here, he sets Abraham on his way, and critically, with his wife and all that he had. So Abram went up, he and his wife and all that he had. You see, so this initial situation is basically the final situation, which is an indication to us that we should read these stories sequentially, you know, see the relationship between these stories as we move on. But that's your basic classic fivefold structure. Now we've got time for some questions, and I have been a little bit miserly in the amount of time for questions, so you may have questions on what we've done in this session or on anything that we've done, you know, from Friday night onwards. Just raise your hand and Mike will race to you with a microphone.
Thank you. Yes, I'm puzzled here. We're talking here about facts of history. The biblical stories are facts of history. Are we speaking here about the inspiration of Scripture, all Scriptures given by inspiration of God, to provide these very, very nice and clear compositions of stories? Is that an influence of the Holy Spirit? Because these are facts of history. Mm-hmm. Were they written down deliberately in this format because that was the way it was done? Or is this inspirational setting down in that format? Because if you're writing a story, you can do what you like with it. You can do that quite easily. Mm. But when this is fact of history, how does this relate to facts of history rather than fiction?
Right. Well, I don't think we necessarily have to make a choice between, you know, is this, I think you were saying, is this a fact of history, or is the opposite you gave me was whether it's fiction or whether it's facts of history. Is that the essential part of it?
As you were describing a story.
Yes.
So did the authors do that deliberately?
Yeah.
Well,
yes. Remember what I said, that these passages, these are products of the Jewish Israelite mind, and for them stories were the way in which you communicated matters of great importance. So what we have, we have history, so we don't have to deny that we're dealing with just with fiction, but this is with it being history, but it is history written as story. And so there are certain conventions for the writing of story, but this is history written as story, because it isn't history written as chronicle, by which I mean it isn't just simply saying this happened, that happened, and something else happened, and may the Lord bless us as we meditate on these matters, all right? It isn't like that. This is history written as story in such a way that we remember those stories, because we are drawn in, and therefore we become part of God's dealings with human beings in history, because that's what stories do. I don't want to use the word entertain us, but they intrigue us. So I don't think it's, sometimes people say, if there's any art in the Bible, it proves it's all fiction. No, I think that's to misunderstand, and not that's what you're saying, but just to misunderstand what art is. So this is history written as story. There's a question over here. I think we've gone.
It's not so much a question, but simply to add to what you've said, it seems, I agree with everything that you said there. Mm-hmm. But there's also a verse in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 11, which gives the purpose behind these stories. Now these things happen to them as an example that they were written for our instruction upon the ends of the ages.
Yeah.
In other words, they're written in a way so that we can relate to them and learn from them, I think.
Yes, okay, thank you. Yeah, that's an important point, is that the more we understand stories, I think the more we're intrigued by them, the more we're drawn to them. And if our interest is piqued by the way in which God's dealings in history are written, well, it just makes it so much more interesting, doesn't it?
Can I follow on this theme? How far are you willing to go with that? Particularly thinking, I'm a bit of a movie fan, and whenever cinema takes on a story about which I know something, particularly if it's a true story, take for example the recent movie a few years back about the Enigma machine and Alan Turing. What they have to do is simplify matters. They have composite characters. They'll have a thing at the end which says, based on a true story, some characters are da-da-da-da. Hmm. Are you proposing that might be the case with some of the stories we think about in the Bible? We've got composite characters. The important thing is the message and the details of who said what to who, why and when aren't that important.
Well, I think that the Bible stories are more concerned with showing us the significance of events than necessarily making sure that every I is dotted and every T is crossed. I think they're more concerned with the significance of it. And we get an insight, I think, into the amount of freedom that biblical writers have if we compare, for example, the three Gospels. Now, you have three lives. We've got John as well, but I'm just dealing with Matthew, Mark, and Luke. They deal with the life of Jesus, and many of the same stories occur in all of those Gospels, or maybe in two of them. But they occur in different orders. And in some of the Gospels, the story is told in such a way as to make a different contribution in Matthew than it does in Mark. So nobody is suggesting, I'm not suggesting that therefore the event didn't happen, we're dealing with fiction, but these authors utilize historical events in order to underline the significance of the life and death of Jesus. So more important than knowing that this happened and then that happened and then at 2 o'clock the following afternoon this happened, you were going to get the right sequence. More important than that is seeing who is Jesus, what is the significance, and I'm going to some extent manipulate the sequence of these things. This is what the gospel writers are doing, in order that the significance of Jesus is seen as clearly as possible. So it's the use of what Jesus said, but with the use of imagination under the guidance of the Spirit. Okay? Yeah, Mike.
This might seem a little complicated, but the Bible, as much other history, goes from several thousand years ago through the BC AD age change to approximately the end of the first century, let's say. Mm. During that time, there was a huge change in the way stories were handed down from orally in the very, very early days to written in the latter time period. And now, of course, 21st century, virtually everything is written down. There is none of the original storytelling, or virtually none. And the repetition is a very good example of how stories were handed down. Say it over and over and over again, and this is how you learn. Mm. The structure, the panel structure and the chiastic structure, which you talked about last night, again, good ways of passing on the story because it's so much easier to remember. My question after that long diatribe is it realistic, feasible to date the writing of the stories by the literary structure which we can now perceive in them? And if so, what might the implications be?
Hmm. Yeah, that's a fairly broad, deep question. Well, the first thing I would say is that what makes a story, which is what we've just been looking at, this basic plot structure, seems to be a universal. So even today, when you look around the 21st century world, no matter what culture you go to, Europe, Africa, Papua New Guinea, South America, stories have the same basic structure. There's something, there's a kind of a story, a plot-shaped hole in all of our minds, no matter what a culture we are or what ethnicity we are, which recognises what a good story is. So in terms of can we recognise or can we date a story in terms of its structure, that I don't think we can. The basic storytelling technique, you know, what makes a good story, I'm not sure about dating. There are some stories in Genesis where there is quite a lot of repetition. Well, you know, the first chapter of Genesis, for example. Is that a sign that it's very early? Because we also get repetition in stories that must have been written, you know, much later on. I don't think I've heard anybody argue on the dating of a story based on this. The way in which stories are normally dated is less to do with, I think, what you were referring to, and more on vocabulary. Is the vocabulary early? Or is the vocabulary late? And it's largely, I think, on that basis that people make their decisions on dating rather than anything else.
Can I have another go? I'm interested in going the other direction from my previous question, perhaps. If you look at the story there about Christ and the coin, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. If you were to just take the words there, you can, and some people have, come up with a theology of how to deal with government, for example. Whereas I think if you look at the story, you're looking at someone who's trying very, very hard not to get himself into serious political problems. Mm-hmm. Christ had to answer that question in a very clever manner to keep his accusers from having more ammunition. And he kind of, doesn't fob it off, but he gets out of that tricky situation. So if you look at that story as Christ trying to be trapped and getting out of a tricky situation, you do not come up with a theology of government. Whereas if you just look at the words that appear in the page and do the kind of proof text thing,
yeah,
you can get yourself a theology of government, which I presume is not something you would recommend.
No, I mean, a text without a context is usually a pretext for something else. So any interpretation has to be contextual. What intrigues me about that story is the final situation after Jesus has said something which we would take as being fairly obvious, right? render to Caesar the things that are Caesar, to gods the things that are gods. We say that's fairly obvious. And their response is they were amazed. Why would they be amazed? What are they amazed at? Are they amazed at the profundity of his thought, or are they amazed at how cleverly he has eluded their attempt to nail him? Okay. Now, I'm not sure, I mean, I see your point. I think I'd be willing to go with you part of the way on that. I think that what Jesus is saying, I don't think he's saying something that he doesn't actually believe. You know, he's not saying render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, but actually I think we should rebel against the Romans as soon as possible. You know, so I don't think his words are, I don't think he's necessarily his words I think must reflect something of his teaching, but they're given in a particular context, which is the important point that you're making. He's responding to hypocrisy.
He's not engaging with the real question, which is behind that, is what happens when rendering to Caesar conflicts with rendering to God, which I suspect... that's what I would have wanted to know. What do I do when the government tells me to do something and God tells me to do something else? And Christ doesn't get to that,
no.
But maybe because that's not important.
No, that's not the point he's wanting to make. In order to make that point, we're going to have a different story. Because remember, stories are great, but they have a limitation. Stories can only really convey one point. And if you want another point, you've got to have another story. You can't cram it all into one thing. But I would say that in this particular story, he is giving some indication of our response to the relationship between God and Caesar. But of course, other passages point out that actually you could read his words to mean that God and Caesar are on an equal plane. But other passages in the New Testament would indicate that actually isn't the case. You know, that we choose to serve God rather than man. You know, this is what the apostles say in Acts, isn't it? So this is a response to this particular situation. But as you say, it isn't the comprehensive answer to every permutation on that issue.
Isn't it true that numerous times when Jesus was faced with questions like that, that he asked a question right back, and so very often he draws the answer from the person who's sort of working on him. Time and time again he makes the person answer their own question, so that it shows that the question was not really legit to start with. They knew the answer, they're just trying to be awkward.
Yes, that's true. And we're used, I suppose, when we watch, if any of you do, watch something like Prime Minister's Question Time, would not my right honourable friend agree, you know, or whatever. Sometimes when I've watched, I thought, doesn't anybody ever give a straight answer? Don't they ever give a straight answer? You know, a bit like, you know, when Nixon was on, for Watergate, the killer question was, Mr. President, what did you know and when did you know it? It's a bit difficult to fudge around that. But the point you make is quite true, that often Christ responds to a question with another question. And here, I think, he may respond to a question with an answer which requires some further reflection along the lines of, but what about, which I think is what you were saying there. So it's a deliberately less than full answer. Because one of the things about, remember Jesus is a rabbi, and rabbinic teaching was often this question back, question and a question back, as a means of arriving at wisdom. And that's what we need. I remember once when I first, I was teaching, in the lecture hall, And I had given, you know, a couple of alternatives. And this exasperated student said, look, I don't care about all these different opinions. Just tell us, what are we supposed to believe? And my reply was, well, I don't really think that's my function as a teacher. My function as a teacher is to help you to think for yourself within guidelines. And I think that's, if I may say so, the kind of thing that Jesus habitually does. Yeah. I think we better take a break and refresh ourselves.